comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right, little darling.
Hey, everybody. This is Eric Mann, back from the 25th anniversary of the Labor Community Strategy Center on June 21st. Then, a week in Jackson, Mississippi, on the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer. It was truly mind-blowing for me. And then, 3 days in Miami, working with the Florida New Majority, the Miami Workers Center, Power You, and many other groups to just get a sense of, also Dream Defenders, to get a sense of some other people in the movement and what people are thinking. Then turn around, come back to LA, and start to get my head screwed on. Now, while I was gone, our amazing team of Julian Lamb, who's a terrific, terrific editor, William Sabarin, who's a film editor down in Mississippi with us, Catherine Murphy, who did the film Maestra, as the head of the literacy project. So the four of us were a team down in Mississippi, and we just did a ton of long interviews and conversations with civil rights veterans, probably 11 to 12. And some of them you've heard already, or hopefully heard. Last Thursday night, we had Derek Johnson from the Mississippi NAACP, and we had Beverly Hogan, the president of Tougaloo. We had Leroy Johnson from Southern Echo, and Hollis Watkins, one of the great, great civil rights leaders, who was on Friday night. Now, this weekend, on Sunday, we're going to be doing an hour special at 9 o'clock in the morning with interviews. It looks like with Danny Glover or with Julian Bond. We're still trying to figure that out. And a woman named Frankie Adams Johnson, a.k.a. Malika, who I'll tell you about. So here's what today's show is about. We've been doing this kind of Black history, significance of Mississippi summer for about 6 weeks. And I think as listeners, you've been great. We're going to go to the phones at around 20 after, 25 after, 818-985-5735. Now, here's the price of admission. You have to talk about one of the voices shows that you heard, because I'm trying to figure out who's out there, what influenced you. So, for instance, the first thing that kicked this off was an interview with William Payne, who wrote the book I've Got the Light of Freedom, and it turned out that was an hour interview. Then you heard Claiborne Carson and Judy Richardson. Claiborne Carson was the head of the Martin Luther King papers, and he wrote a book called SNCC, The Awakening of Black Power. And Judy Richardson is a longtime veteran of the civil rights movement, including Mississippi Summer, who's gone on to do all kinds of film, and I believe she's at Brown University right now. And then you heard, as I said, the Leroy Johnson interview and the other interviews that I mentioned. So one of our questions is, were you listening? And could you comment on any of the shows? I hope it's okay that if you say, hi, I have an opinion, but if you can't respond to this show, I'm going to ask you to please not be on the line, because we're trying to figure out, as you can imagine, doing all these shows, what influence are they having on our listeners? So I'm going to start out with some of the thoughts I have, maybe for about 15 minutes, on immersing myself in Black history, immersing myself in these interviews down in Mississippi, immersing myself in seeing a film, a two-hour film called Freedom Summer, and just tell you some initial thoughts that I have. And then we want to go to the phones, 818-985-5735. Remember, you have to respond, please, to one of the last five shows we've done on the history of Mississippi to give us a sense who's out there. And at 4:20, we're going to go to the phones. So please call up at 818-985-5735. So it's been a pretty amazing experience for me. So many things to talk to you about. The first thing I think is important is this constant effort for me to figure out Black history. I realize, is for me, Black history is U.S. history. Black history is revolutionary history. Black history is the centerpiece of the third world inside the United States. So Black history is of course, also deeply affected Chicano Latino history. It's affected the American Indian movement. It's affected the white anti-racist movement, Asian Pacific Islander movements, women's movements. So it is not, as it's portrayed sometimes, as, well, that's good, but you're talking about black history. I would argue that some of the very finest people who have thought about the entire United States from the perspective that I share are black organizers, black scholars, you know, from Toni Cade Bambara and the Black Woman series to Fannie Lou Hamer, Annie Devine, Vivian Gray, you know, and all the people that worked at the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. So let me tell you a couple of thoughts about what's changed in my mind or gotten reinforced in my mind since we've been talking. I think the first thing is that I have a book that I'd really urge you to get. It's called Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. And it's published by Frontlines Press, and you can get it online. The reason I urge you to look at that book is that's the first time I think I played with more clearly the concept of the United States as a series of reconstructions and racist counterattacks. Specifically, of course, totally built on the classic book by W.E.B. Du Bois, Black Reconstruction America. So I didn't invent this. I maybe extended somewhat the line of argument. But the basic argument is that the United States was founded on slavery, that the United States was founded on the genocide of indigenous people, the stealing of land, the cotton trade, the stealing of northern Mexico and the annexation of northern Mexico, the exploitation of Asian immigrant workers, and of course the exploitation of white workers as well. But the super exploitation of the third world workers and the super exploitation of third world people is the sort of central theme. And the reason why that's important is that one of my differences with Occupy, which I'm also going to write about, is that I realize I just fundamentally do not agree with Occupy. I think they've done some wonderful, wonderful stuff. I mean that. But I think the formulation of the 1% against the 99% is just too much about the United States. It's a raceless concept. It sort of says there's a 1% that owns the country and there's 99% of us who don't. I don't think that's accurate. But more importantly, it doesn't talk about the super profits and imperialism. It doesn't put out the fact that it's not our 100% to divide up. The wealth of the United States is ill-gotten. The wealth of the United States is stolen. And for Occupy to keep talking about the 1% and the 99%, but not talk about it is a world question, that the United States is the greatest danger to the entire world, is not a minor difference. It's a profound difference. And just to be clear, I think in some ways Occupy perpetuated a great nation chauvinism inside the United States, which is, it's our money, but we have to redivide it differently. And the reason I'm talking about that is that third world narrative that I'm giving you is a third world narrative. I mean, there's almost no indigenous scholar that not only would not disagree with me, but would say, thanks for reading my books. There's very few black scholars and Latinos, if you read Occupied America, History of Chicanos by Rudy Acuna, which they're trying to get out of the schools before the Mayflower. So many books have had this sort of anti-imperialist narrative. So then you have the situation of Mississippi in 1964. So one of the things that's important that I got, what did I learn differently? The first thing I learned is that I want to go back from Robin Kelly's important book. It's the book about the black organizers in Alabama who formed the Communist Party, Hammer and Hoe is the name of the book. And it's about the fact that during the 1930s, the Communist Party was very active in Alabama to the point that the majority of people in the Communist Party in Alabama were black sharecroppers. So the history, it goes way, way back, but at least we start with the 1930s and that. The second important thing that I got even more clear, I would say in terms of a new idea, is I don't think I fully grasped the role of World War II and Korea on the black movement, that so many men, in particular black men, came back. Now, there are stories, of course, about black men coming back, having been treated not equally, but better in the army, because the army had to figure out a way for them to fight, and treated even better in Europe than they were in the United States, coming back, and of course the Southern racists needing to immediately try to humiliate them. That's been understood by me, What I didn't understand is that the overwhelming majority of them did not give their guns back. The concept was sort of, I sort of understood that the nonviolent movement in the South, that there were certain people with guns. I didn't understand that the black community was fully armed, that almost everybody had a gun in their house, that people had guns in their glove compartments, that it wasn't a nonviolent movement with some people who had guns, but it was fundamentally an armed movement that didn't know what to do. It wasn't ready for black insurrection, but it certainly was ready for black self-defense. So the story about Robert Williams from the NAACP, who did defend himself and argued for black self-defense, wrote a book called Negroes with Guns. Again, I didn't grasp that he was not as, I wouldn't say isolated, but he wasn't as unique as I thought. 818-985-5735. If you want to talk about black history, if you want to talk about the last shows that we've done, please call. I'm very much interested in hearing what you have to say. So the first thing that I learned was, first of all, from Hollis Watkins. I learned it from Clay Carson in the interview that we did here, in which he said that, first of all, the level of people that were armed, but secondly, the idea that Clay Carson said that the black movement was always internationalist, and that the one man, one vote slogan, which was used in the South, actually came from Africa. And so it wasn't like people were just trying to change the United States and then later developed a pro-African point of view, but not just from Marcus Garvey, but from, again, traveling the world and fighting in an anti-colonial struggle during World War II, raised the consciousness of many black people in the South. Second thing I learned from I've Got the Light of Freedom, and again, from the interviews that we did in the South, is how much the NAACP was a force throughout the 30s, throughout the 40s, throughout the 50s, and created the infrastructure for SNCC, for CORE, for even the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Again, because I came from the North, and because I studied the NAACP from the top down, I knew a lot about Roy Wilkins, frankly, sabotaging of many of the militants in the civil rights movement. But as Derek Johnson pointed out, who's the state chairman of the Mississippi NAACP, the NAACP has had a bottom-up, membership-driven politics so that the Mississippi chapters were helping to support the national office. 818-985-5735. They were not afraid of the national office, and if Roy Wilkins said things that they didn't agree with, that they couldn't stop him, but that didn't mean they didn't do what they wanted to do. So it's not just the question of Amzie Moore, 818-985-5735, a gentleman named Steptoe, and in the interview we heard with Derek Johnson, he talks about 8, 10, 12 early leaders of the NAACP, all the way from the Niagara Movement to the present, who, Niagara Movement was 1911, who, as he said, were often doctors, lawyers, owned their own businesses. They were moderately affluent in a sense, but they were armed, and they were also armed intellectually. So that's the second thing I learned, is that I didn't appreciate enough the role that the NAACP had played in creating the structure for the conversations. I'm going to go to the phones, and I can talk and go to the phones. So let's talk with Alfonso and Carson. Hey, Alfonso.
Greetings.
How you doing?
Greetings, family. You know, I am inspired by what you're doing.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, KPFK opens the doors for evolution, revolution. And my feeling, my brother, is that the courage that the students, the young people, found to go to the South, which had a reputation for straight out violence historically, yet through ideology, principle, faith, whatever it was, walked into that furnace. And as we approach the reality of their commitment now, KPFK, through their broad programming, gives the opportunity for people who may lack the courage, because times are different. The 60s are not right now. However, through stations like KPFK and their multifaceted programming, those of us who read a book but don't who dare to step out of their off of their couches or out of their front door, through listening to KPFK and their very programming, can find the sustenance or the courage, the intestinal fortitude to you know, just out of embarrassment, because the students that went to the South, you know, and yet they did that. And that's what I got from listening to the programming concerning the young spirits that went to the South.
And that's great, Alfonso. I want to respond, actually, to, I think what you said was really great, because I think what you said was, whether it was their ideology or their faith or their spirit, I think it was all three. And I think one of the things that, again, was very moving to me, and there's a new film, and I'm, you know, did not write the name of the filmmaker who's won several Oscars. It's called Mississippi Summer, I believe, and we saw it down in Mississippi. And one of the things that really, I think, shook everybody is that people were being trained in Oxford, Ohio, in like June of 1964. And this, we're talking about like 500 people, most of whom were white, about to go down south when they found out that Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman and James Chaney were missing. And then within a couple of days, everyone understood what missing meant, even though they hadn't found the bodies yet. And they still went. In fact, they went even with more commitment, knowing. The second thing I was very struck by in talking to the people who are now my age, but who were in 1964 in Mississippi, they tell it in a kind of funny way, a nice way, but everybody is telling me about when somebody hit them upside the head with a club or threw a rock in their face, or, you know, one guy with the SNCC Freedom Singers was telling me, well, I was telling this woman who was, we were in the church, and everybody was panicking, and I was telling her, don't panic, don't panic. And then somebody took a rock and cracked me over the head. And as I'm falling to the floor, I go, don't panic. And then he passed out. So imagine being around 750 or 1,000 people like that. And I think you're right that KPFK is trying to generate the kind of program that is going to get people off their couch.
And it's a preparation. Yes, sir.
Well, I'm going to give it to you. So one thing I'd like you to do, and thank you very much, Alfonso, for calling, is if you're interested, you can call the Strategy Center at just one place, my own organization, 213-387-2800, and ask how you could volunteer to do some civil rights in the present. And thank you so much for calling. Can we go to our next caller? Mars, and this is Eric Mann at 818-985-5735. We're discussing Mississippi Summer, Black History, and hopefully some of the shows that you've listened to while I was down in Mississippi. Morris, is that you?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, nice to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm G. Morris Band. And the thing, I heard you mention Marcus Garvey, and I'm an avid listener to your radio station, but I never hear nobody speak of Noble Drew Ali. And Noble Drew Ali did a lot for our people that really went unnoticed.
Why don't you tell
me? He brought our nationality back to our people, our culture, and our creed. Because as long as we consider ourselves as black, Negro, or color, we have no nationality. So we're never really represented as a people of a nation. You know, we have to go back to who we were before we were taken into slavery. And the last name that we were called were Moors. So all of us of African descent are Moors. And our ancestors, what people fail to realize, helped set up the Constitution, because it was 30 Moors and 20 Europeans that drafted the Constitution for the United States. And America keeps talking about a democracy when this is a republic. Congress never sanctioned a democracy. And that's the plight that's wrong with our people. We're calling ourselves crayons instead of being part of a nation. You know, that's the thing that's corrupt with this country.
Morris, thank you. I want to respond to what you said. I think it's very good what you said. I just finished reading Stokely, A Life, by Peniel Joseph. And what I got out of it, and this is about what you're saying, Morris, is that there have been three main trends in black militancy, I would say. One has been the civil rights trend, which was in no way liberal, in no way liberal. It was fighting very, very hard to radicalize the concept of democracy in the United States. It had the idea of a black land base. It had the idea of a Black Panther Party, which came out of, as you know, John Hewlett and Stokely's work in Lowndes County Freedom Organization in 1965. So it's not like the civil rights movement was ever truly integrationist. That's my interpretation of it. It was very radical and was trying to both integrate and take over in many ways the institutions of the United States. Then you had the Black Power movement, which Willie Ricks and Stokely and others didn't start, but gave a lot of emphasis to, which focused heavily on a more national identity, black people as an oppressed nation inside the United States. And then you had Pan-Africanism, which was initiated by many, many people. And I think maybe the third is where you would put your own thoughts, or the second. And the Pan-Africanists, which is Stokely changed his name to Kwame Ture, in the name of both Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Ture. He went to Africa. He went back and forth to the United States. He formed the All-African Revolutionary People's Party. And here's what I was reading that concerned me, that inside the Black United Front and inside the whole left in the United States, I think it was a mistake to have this level of antagonism, period, inside the Black United Front, but in particular between three ideologies that I think were much more compatible, which is civil rights, black power, and Pan-Africanism. Many people moved in and out of those points of view or held them simultaneously. Many people, for instance, were more socialist, Pan-African socialist. Some were black power socialists. Some were black power capitalists. But what I'm getting to is, when I was reading the book, Stokely said, well, first I went through civil rights, then I went through black power, and now I'm a Pan-Africanist. And I did not read the book with that same interpretation of his life, which he's allowed, obviously he's the main person to tell us what his life means. But I felt like, why were you counterposing those three theories when, in fact, you held all three of them, and I think all three are much more integral. 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. Who we got on the phone now? Morris? Another Morris. How you doing?
Hey, that seems to be a popular name today. Hello.
All right.
I have been listening to your programs the last few weeks, and I must confess I didn't have my notebook out like I usually do, taking down names and people who were interviewed, but I have been connecting the dots. And one of my favorite people, of course, is Fannie Lou Hamer. My daddy was from Greenwood, Mississippi. Y'all know the history of that little boy that got killed down there.
Yeah.
And from listening to your program, it has motivated me. I'm trying to take the bull by the horn and get a massive voter registration going on in this country. A man by the name of Benjamin Jealous, the former CEO of the NAACP, along with the Center of American Progress, wrote a 50-page study showing how the dynamics of Washington could radically change by the end of the year if people got out and voted for massive voter registration had taken place, particularly in the 17 states that have always had a poor opinion of us. The Democratic Party, you would think, would invest the $50 million that it would take to make this come to pass. But the Democratic Party has taken more money from Wall Street than the Republican Party has, so that tells me that the common man does not have a voice in Washington. So I just want you to know, from listening to your program, I've gotten motivated to want to do something. This is something I can do. And on the final note, I want to say we've got what are called the Ten Commandments of the People of the United States. Number one, stop corporate money in elections. Number two, a progressive income tax. Number three, $1 trillion infrastructure investment. Number four, the elimination of student loan debt. Number five, the freedom to love. Number six, stop privatization of public services. Number seven, no fast-track trade agreement. Number eight, no spying on the public, but spying on public officials. Number nine, decriminalization of drugs. And number 10, a universal health care. And I know it's the 50-year anniversary. That things may not have changed a lot, it seems, but they have changed. But one of the things these folks have done for us is they've given us inspiration. Now, the first time the kids went down there for nothing, this time they're getting ready to go down there to eliminate some debt. So I think this is a good motivator for them too. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, and thank you for a very coherent and moving presentation. Let me respond to Morris on a couple of things. I hope you're still listening. The first thing is other things I've learned. How important voter registration is and how important the vote is. There's a real crisis right now, Morris and other listeners, in terms of black voting, that blacks are still undervoting for their percentages. The second thing is, of course, you know that blacks are totally trapped inside the Democratic Party, which doesn't mean that I know where they should go. But I think one of the problems is not just they're trapped inside the Democratic Party, but having terrible, terrible problems influencing the Democratic Party. Because again, one of the things I got out of the Mississippi trip was not so much from Eleanor Holmes Norton and other black elected officials, but from the floor, is that the president's decision to not talk about race, which is Hollis Watkins' point, and not talk about poverty. Oh, there's a little bit discussion about, what do you call it, income inequality. I mean, how's that for a revolutionary thought? But the fact that the basic strategy is to leave black folks alone because they got nowhere else to go, to focus a lot on the white vote and to focus on the Latino vote. And they've done studies to indicate that the white vote is declining, but you still got to get about 40% of the white vote. And then you got to get 66%, this is Democratic strategists talking, of the Latino vote. And you know you're going to get 98% of the black vote. So imagine that it still means that the party, the Democratic Party, is going after the Latino voter, is going after the white voter, and sees the black community as a liability, even though the black community is their most loyal friend. So what Morris was saying, and Ben Jealous is now working at the Center for American Progress, which is very interesting. I mean, that's a very liberal think tank, very pro-Democratic Party think tank. But still, the idea of massive voter registration of black folks, I think, is absolutely essential, because what I'm understanding better is this is going to be everything from taking over cities and taking over towns, or maybe, yeah, just getting one more member of Congress, but at least being an organized force in the electoral arena. And yet, as Morris pointed out, the Democratic Party is not putting the $50 million in to register black voters. And one reason, in my opinion, is because when that word gets out, it's going to scare white voters. And that's tragic, but that's what I think may be going on is, yeah, we could register more black voters. But as the word gets out, since they're doing so much work to disenfranchise black voters, that might scare whites into the Republican Party. So I think that the proposal that Ben Jealous has come, I'm going to check it out. I'm going to read the thing with the Center for American Progress. And I think that the fight for black and Latino voter registration and voter rights is a really critical issue. And I want to thank you for bringing that to my attention. 818-985-5735. We're talking about lessons from Mississippi Summer and lessons from the 50th anniversary of Mississippi Summer that I've been talking about on the phone. As you know, we've invested a tremendous amount of time in the programming. I want to tell you a little bit about some upcoming program. We still got plenty of time to talk. 818-985-5735. So the first thing is that we have more people coming in terms of who we're going to have on the show. There have not been as many women on the show yet. We did have Beverly Hogan, the president of Tougaloo College, who I want to talk about for a minute. We have coming up, we think this Sunday, Frankie Adams Johnson, a.k.a. Malika, as she say, Frankie in the South, Malika in New York. Very interesting woman, who I'll tell you about a little bit. And then we're also going to have, not Sunday, but again, a subsequent, Gwendolyn Zahara Simmons. What's interesting about both of these women is that they left the South. They were in SNCC. They both moved on to black revolutionary organizations. Frankie moved on to the Panthers. Gwen moved on to, just about the Republic of New Africa, the Panthers, the Nation of Islam. So one of the things I think is very interesting is for some scholar to do, not me, but would be to track the political development of the people who left Mississippi Summer and where did they go. 818-985-5735. For instance, in another interview you're going to hear with Julian Bond, who I think many of you know, he was a famous member of SNCC. He was elected, amazingly, to the Georgia State Legislature in 1965 or 1966. And as he won the election, he walked in, and because SNCC was anti-war and because he was black, the all-white legislature refused to seat him. So they had another election. You know, that's what the UAW used to do when we voted down a contract. They said, we're going to keep voting until we get it right. So they had another election. He won again, and he wasn't seated. He did another legal appeal, and some combination of winning the third election plus the legal appeal, Julian Bond became a member of the Georgia State Assembly. When I asked Julian, what did you do after Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, when a lot of people left the Democratic Party, he said, I stayed in the Georgia legislature for 28 years. And liked it. In other words, he picked his, and then he became the chair of the board of the president of the board of the National NAACP. So what I'm getting to is fascinating. You know, he doesn't say I'm right and you're wrong. He said I made a choice. And the exciting thing about many of the Mississippi summer leaders is how long they have gotten involved and stayed involved. So all of them that I interviewed actually are still active. Duh. I just realized that that's one of the things that Julian and Catherine and William agreed on, that the people we wanted to interview were the 50-year long-distance runners who were still doing work in their communities. 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. Let's go to the phones. Is this Rudolph?
Hello there.
Is this Rudolph?
Yes, Rudolph.
Good to hear from you, brother. What's up?
Okay. I've been listening to you, and I listened to a couple of your programs before, and you're talking about the commemoration of the Civil Rights March and everything. One thing that has happened that you just mentioned, how everything has changed, and the key thing is the consciousness of new people coming in. Because one thing that your adversaries will do is that they're going to do their homework, and they're going to find out what's the best way to try to do things where they won't make mistakes like what happened before. Because back in the 60s, you had people coming down to get people to vote, and they had to face that straight-up prejudice. Now, they're doing it legally. And the idea is that in order for them to come up and at least put in a word to voters, that they have to go and put money up, and then they have obstacles in their way, even when they go to try to put their money up to get an ID card. So the other thing also to add on to this is how during the Bush administration, how John Ashcroft, anytime some kind of person wanted to speak out against something like this one individual did in Washington, he got on the Internet and used the fist, and John Ashcroft put him in jail as a means to tell everybody else, don't you try this or we're going to come after you.
Well, Rudolph, let me respond to both your points because they're both very good. The first thing I think you're absolutely right about is the ruling class responded to the civil rights movement. They had studies. The first thing I want to start with, the second point about repression. In reading again, Peniel Joseph book on Stokely, but Bearing the Cross by David Garrow and so on, it's almost taken for granted that every single person was being tapped. Miriam Makeba and Stokely Carmichael were being listened to, check this out, by the State Department, the Department of Defense, the CIA, the FBI, and Lyndon Johnson was getting daily reports on Stokely Carmichael. J. Edgar Hoover was doing daily reports on Martin Luther King. When I was in CORE in 1965, King told people that the FBI was not doing its job in Mississippi. J. Edgar Hoover called him in, and this is in books, but we heard it before it was in books, and said, well, listen, I have a tape of every hotel you've been in. I have a tape of everything you've done for the last year, that's all I'll say. And I'm going to release those tapes. And they said that King walked out gravely shaken. Now, he pulled it together. But my point, so your first point is absolutely right. The repression, that's not new. The repression is integral to how the United States suppresses social movements, and it's even gotten worse. But your second point is very good, which is, as was your first, that we went all this time fighting the poll tax, the grandfather clause, how many bubbles are in a bar of soap. And as people got past those, and as they were ruled out of order, eventually, under the Voting Rights Act, seven states were essentially put in trusteeship, where any new changes in voting rights had to be sent to the Justice Department for approval. In the new Supreme Court decision, they said, well, that's old. We don't need to do that anymore. So those seven states are sort of taken off probation. I should know which ones. I'm sure Mississippi is one of them. So the point is that now the state can initiate anything it wants, and you can still appeal it to the Justice Department, but it's already going into effect. And so your point, which is absolutely right, is,
Eric?
Yes.
Okay, one thing that you can do is also, this goes back to history, because once you go back to the period of Reconstruction,
right,
how during the Supreme Court during that time, every kind of action dealing with black people during the time of Reconstruction from the 1876 on up, the Plessy, was kicked back down to the states. And this is what they're doing now. everything has been devised by the states.
Completely agree, Ro. I completely agree. And this new stuff about states' rights, right, which is integral. I want to thank you because I want to move on to some of the callers, but thanks a lot for paying attention, and thanks a lot for some very good calls. Stay in touch. We'll have you on Voices from the Frontlines again. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. Very enjoyable conversation with our listeners. This is 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. And listeners, please check out our site, www.voicesfromfrontlines.com. We don't have the in there yet, so it's voicesfromfrontlines.com. You can click down and hear. I just was in Mississippi, so I didn't hear the interviews that I did myself. I went back and I played the Hollis Watkins interview that Julian Lamb did such a beautiful job of editing, just kind of unbelievable. Then I went back and listened to the Derek Johnson interview because it's a strange thing. When I'm interviewing people, I'm paying great attention to every word they're saying, but I'm also trying to think of, well, where are they going? What are they thinking about? Where should I take the conversation? And so I do it, and then when I'm finished with the conversation, I don't remember it real well. So then I go back and listen to the tapes, and I have to say, pretty good. You know, these are, so, folks, everybody I've mentioned is right now on www.voicesfromfrontlines.com. You can hear the Beverly Hogan interview, and what a cool woman, the 13th president of Tougaloo College, which is one of the historically black colleges and universities, the first black woman, I believe woman and black woman, to be the president of Tougaloo, whereas where we held it. So these are terrific interviews. Please go online and then send me something at eric@voicesfromfrontlines.com. I would love to hear from you. eric@voicesfromfrontlines.com. All right, back to the phones. Phil and Galita.
Eric.
Phil.
I listened to those interviews, and I want to thank you for them. I think they were incredibly informative. Certainly expanded my view, but I didn't hear one thing, and I wanted to ask you about it since you brought it up earlier, and that is the connection between Pan-Africanism and Islam in the struggle in Freedom Summer. I didn't hear anything about that, and I know it was there because those slaves brought Islam with them when they were forced over here, and they kept to that faith, and people were coming down from the north. There were the Garveyites that were going into the Caribbean, and I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that brought out in the Freedom Summer struggle.
Thank you, Phil. Let me respond to it the best I understand it. The first thing I want to say is that everything I understood about the dominant religious impact in the South was the black Protestant tradition, whether it was AME or Baptist, mainly Baptist. Secondly, that you know that there's been a long, long history of slaves being both, quote, forcibly converted to Christianity and trying to find ways to circumvent Christianity through songs, through chants that were very complicated because they have to be understood by the slaves and not the slave masters. So I will say this, that the deep impact of the Christian church was the central religious frame for the civil rights movement. But secondly, to give King a great deal of credit, he was a preacher of what you called the social gospel. In fact, King was in a lot of trouble. He went to theology school, got a PhD in theology, because the social gospel fundamentally rejected the concept of faith, rejected the concept of a God that had the ultimate moral decision, but rather argued that your actions on earth were the determination of holiness. So King at one point was essentially being accused of being a closet atheist, hiding behind the Christian scripture. Second thing I want to say is that the general tendency of people in the South was very secular, but nonetheless, the church, and again, I've learned so much, I just have to realize how much I've learned just by going down there. I didn't understand how much the church was the physical fortress. The church was where people went to hide, or went for mass meetings, or went to accumulate enough of a black critical mass. So I would argue to you that while you could be interested in the theory of what Muslim impact had, from everybody I've talked to, that was not a dominant perspective. And I want to thank you for the call. Keep going, and let's hear another listener. Let's see if Barbara, well, you tried before. I hope you can get you on now.
Okay. I heard a lot of the shows, too. And the woman you just referred to, who is the president of Tougaloo College?
Yes.
What was her name?
Her name was Beverly Hogan.
Hogan.
Check her out. Go ahead, Barbara. You talk, and then I'm going to tell you some interesting stories about her.
Yeah, well, I think she's the one I wanted to refer to. There may have been more discussion than I heard about the current black leadership and the Obama regime. Was there a general view of what's going on with leadership today and Obama's regime in particular that was voiced down there?
Well, tell me first your opinion for a minute, and then I'll tell you what I heard down there. Because it was I heard many things. It wasn't one thing. But what's your thought? And then I'll tell you, and thank you so much for the question.
Now, you know I can't say what I think
all right,
about
then,
Obama.
Okay, then I'll say what I heard. Is that okay?
We're about getting you all kicked off the air. Anyway, go ahead.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Barbara. Well, listen, it's really fascinating because there were three black elected officials up there, and there were three congresspeople. They're all members of Congress. And I did not write, one was from Mississippi, and one was from, I don't remember, and then one was Eleanor Holmes Norton, who was the only member of the House of Representatives from the District of Columbia. Now, these were good people. These were, well, Eleanor Holmes Norton comes out of the freedom struggle. One of the younger guys didn't, but here was the main point, that they were trying to make the case about the Republican Party, right? They were trying to talk about Republican redistricting, Republican this, Republican that. They were talking about, they gently criticized other black elected officials, but they even pointed out, which is interesting and important, that the Republicans are now running black people in black districts as Democrats. Check this out. That is to say, because black people will not vote for a Republican, the Republicans are actually cultivating black conservative candidates who will run in the Democratic primary and sometimes get elected. Now, I would say to them again, is that the Republicans' problem? I mean, if the Republicans can organize a conservative black person to win, what are you guys doing? And they were heavily criticized from the floor. For instance, there's this issue going on about Moral Monday that's taking place in North Carolina they didn't talk about. Here's something interesting. One person got up and said, you must talk about reparations, right? You must talk about reparations. And they just said, thank you so much. That was really good. Would not address it. Another thing that was raised from the floor was, what are we going to do about H. Rapp Brown, who was convicted of murder, was sentenced to life imprisonment without possibility of parole, but back to this cruel and unusual punishment, has been in solitary for 6 years. He's wasting away. He's sick. And they said, what are we going to do about that? And this is not even a black elected official. Someone else said, that's a very good point. Anybody interested should go over there. Meaning, if you've been an experienced organizer, that's a way of killing it from the floor. What they should have said is, I totally agree. We should try to, maybe what we would do on the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer is all agree to speak out on reparations and all agree to speak out against H. Rapp Brown, who was, you know, against the treatment of H. Rapp Brown. But no, both of those were clearly shuttled. Teresa El Amin was the woman who raised the issue of reparations. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that on the stage, there were a multiplicity of different points of view. There were certain people on the Mississippi Summer who were clearly pro-Democrat. There was no criticism of Obama from the stage. Unbelievable. There was very little struggle with the Democratic Party. There was no discussion of Iraq from the stage. But the overall group from the floor was terrific. And, you know, the last thing I would say is it was still, you have to remember, a reunion. Sorry, this is important because I missed him. Willie Ricks, who was very close to Stokely, who initiated the Black Power chant on the Mississippi March with James Meredith, I think it was 1966, when Meredith tried to integrate the University of Mississippi and successfully did so. And then he had a march, I think a one-person march for civil rights, and he was shot along the way. So King and Stokely and Whitney Young and all the civil rights leaders came and did this march through Mississippi. On the march, we don't know, you know, history is made, Stokely Carmichael and Willie Ricks and you have to remember this was never said before. They were saying freedom now, and they were saying black power, freedom now, black power. And all of a sudden, people started picking up black power, black power. King was in a very difficult situation, and bear with me a minute in my last minute or two, but this is important. King's an amazing figure. I mean, the more I study him, the more I admire him. He was very worried about not black power. He agreed with black power. But it was a tactical dilemma for him because he knew that was going to drive the whites away, and he had been working very hard to cultivate the whites. On the other hand, he did not suppress it. He started finding his own way to talk about it. He found his own way to even defend it. And to give King enormous credit, when they asked him to condemn the rebellions, he said, "How can I condemn black people with arms in the ghetto when my country is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world?" And they say, "What do you think of black power? Disassociate yourself with Stokely Carmichael." King wouldn't do it. He said, "That's just not how I argue it. I think what Stokely is doing is addressing the tremendous," it's paraphrasing, "but the tremendous frustration our people," which is already talking about oppressed people, "our people feel alienated from the system. Our people feel disregarded. And that's what you're going to get." And I think he did a brilliant job of always saying, "Okay, that's not my philosophy, but at the rate you guys are going, that's what you're going to get." So King's influence on Mississippi Summer was very important. All right, I've just been told that we have to get off. So a couple of things. I really want to thank everybody. You know, and the callers today have been great. I think we'll do the phones more for a while. I miss you all. I do. It's great for me when I go to the phones. I also want to thank our listeners. You're smart. You're really smart. You know how to make your point. Yes, yes, yes. Okay. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Thanks so much. I want to thank our producer, Crystal McMillan. I want to thank G, as always, for getting me on time and getting me out of here. Goodbye. See you next week, Tuesday at 4. Check out Voices Sunday at 9, special program.